many industries lobby members of Congress for legislation that helps them and against measures that hurt them. But few have had the influence and political power that the tobacco industry did in its heyday.
Smoking has been a big part of American culture over many decades, but the political support of the industry often flew under the radar, and the general public was not always aware.
Sarah Mylove is an assistant professor of history at the University of Virginia. She's the author of The Cigarette, A Political History. Sarah, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's a really interesting topic and a really big part of American history. Tobacco is a uniquely American crop. When was it first grown on the continent?
Well, tobacco is the story of America insofar as colonists were growing it at Jamestown, sometimes in lieu of growing food. So it's really been part of American history, you know, for hundreds and hundreds of years. But the story of the cigarette itself as a product, doesn't really get going until the late 19th and early 20th centuries.
And so how did tobacco and cigarettes gain such political clout in the United States?
Yeah, so in the late 19th century, it's a period of economic consolidation, economic growth, urbanization, and within tobacco, the man that stands out as really the robber baron for tobacco is a man by the name of James B. Duke of Duke University fame. And Duke really ends up cornering the market on the technological process that allows for the mechanization of cigarettes, so that cigarettes were once rolled by children by hand in factories. Under the Duke Trust, it ends up being produced by machines and therefore more cheaply. And that's kind of the genesis of the smoking industry. But what really happens, the significant thing that happens, is the First World War. Wars are crucially important to the domestication of tobacco and making smoking socially acceptable.
So tell us about that. There are all of these American soldiers who have gone over to Europe to fight in what was not then known as the First World War, but we know it as that now. How did tobacco play into their experience?
You know, I think one thing many people might be surprised to learn is that prior to the 1930s, when Americans consumed tobacco, they were not likely at all to consume it in a cigarette. They were much more likely to chew it, to smoke it in a pipe, to maybe nurse it in a cigar. That smoking a mechanically produced cigarette was considered an immigrant vice. It was actually a foreign import into the United States. The people who did that were the people living in cities frequently. Cigarette smoking was associated with kind of juvenile delinquency. There was kind of a eugenic inflected temperance movement against cigarettes. And before the United States entered World War I, a handful of states had even passed laws prohibiting the sale of cigarettes in their state, which, you know, it really was surprising for me to learn before I became steeped in this research. But the war changes all of that. And in part, it's because cigarette smoking is the kind of vice that seems rather tame in comparison to other vices, let's say young men could get up to out there on the European front. And so you see organizations like the YMCA and the Red Cross, both of which played a really important part as civil service organizations during the war, going from opposing cigarette consumption for young people to during the war actually helping to raise funds to buy soldiers cigarettes and handing out cigarettes at canteens.
Well, and what we know about one of the effects of smoking tobacco is a calming effect. People will sometimes smoke because they're feeling anxious or nervous. And certainly what we know now about the horrors of World War One and the first really documented cases of PTSD, which they called
shell shock.
Thank you. It's not surprising that it would have become a pretty popular habit as well.
Right. I mean, smoking is something that you can do to calm the nerves, to do something with your hands. You can do it quietly with your fellow soldiers. There's kind of a solidarity in lighting up a cigarette together. And then again, it's also something you can do in solitude if you need a moment to yourself. So it's not hard to understand why maybe the Army would have encouraged or at least not discouraged cigarette consumption for soldiers at the front.
We're talking with Sarah Mylove right now. She's an assistant professor of history at the University of Virginia. We're talking about her new book, The Cigarette, A Political History. And you can join the conversation by giving us a call at 800-642-1234. And Sarah, you talked about that in World War I. It was certainly the case in World War II as well. Can you share some of the other ways that the tobacco industry and the federal government really supported each other and were in this very symbiotic relationship?
Yeah, so one way the federal government worked to support tobacco was through a very extensive and very generous subsidy program for tobacco growers. And that gets started during the New Deal, during the 1930s. And the philosophy here is that agriculture was then centrally important to the American economy. And if you wanted to get people in factories working again, people in the countryside also had to have incomes, that the American economic sectors were interrelated. And so it was important to get agriculture back up on its feet. And so for tobacco, what was inaugurated was a very extensive program of supply management, so restricting very rigidly the amount of tobacco that could be grown, and a very generous system of price support. So ensuring, kind of like a minimum wage, that any farmer who brought his tobacco to auction would be assured a minimum price. And this program of supply management and subsidy lasted a remarkably long time. It lasted until 2004. So that is 5 decades, 50 years after the Surgeon General issued the report on the famous report on smoking and health in 1964.
And that subsidy lasting so many decades, is that unusual? Are they usually more short-term boosts for industries instead of an ongoing kind of infusion?
Well, tobacco was a particularly long-lived, even within the context of agricultural subsidies. So in the 1980s and 1990s, there were major revisions to farm laws, but because of the importance of, in a sense, Southern Democrats in the 1930s, the tobacco program was actually written separately from the rest of the farm bills. So tobacco always had kind of a separate kind of largesse applied to it. And so even though many other forms of direct subsidy and support ended for many farmers in the 1990s, tobacco held on until, a decade later.
What about individual politicians who were really the standard bearers for continued support of tobacco much longer than perhaps it would have lasted without them?
Well, there was a very prominent within tobacco world representative, a man by the name of Harold Cooley, who represented a tobacco growing district in North Carolina. And this once again speaks to the power of really Southern Democrats for the middle decades of the 20th century. Cooley ends up being the longest serving chair on the House Agricultural Committee, a very powerful committee, particularly in the middle decades, the mid 20th century. He's the longest serving chair even to this date. He served for nearly uninterrupted for 3 decades. Through his ability to decide, what gets debated, what even rises to the issue, rises to the level of a political issue in front of his committee, he's able to steward the program for quite a long time.
Well, and I was very interested to learn that Jesse Helms, who was a longtime Republican senator from North Carolina, was actually news director for the Tobacco Radio Network before he went to Congress. So clearly he, too, was very much in front of that.
Jesse Helms plays a really interesting role in the 1980s, though perhaps some farmers in the 1980s might have seen him more as a friend to the cigarette manufacturers rather than their particular champion.
We're talking with Sarah Mylove right now. She's an assistant professor of history at the University of Virginia. She's the author of The Cigarette, A Political History.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you're a current or former smoker. How did you originally start? Did you ever feel manipulated by advertising or powerful interests that supported the industry? What changes have you seen in the tobacco industry, the way it relates to the government, and what questions do you have for our guest about this political history of cigarettes? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org.
Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're continuing our conversation with Sarah Mylove right now. She's an assistant professor of history at the University of Virginia and the author of the new book, The Cigarette, A Political History.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you smoke? Did you? What's your take on how dominant the tobacco industry has been, or at least once was, in the United States? If you're a non-smoker, what's it been like being able to work in and patronize non-smoking businesses? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
And let's go to the phones. And Roy in Portage is up. Hi, Roy.
Yeah, hi. How are you doing?
Good. What'd you like to share?
Well, years ago when I first joined the military, go out on maneuvers, part of the sea rations that they would give us, it had a little package with three cigarettes and a pack of matches in it. So, you know, in a way, the military kind of helped a lot of people start smoking. And I smoked for 25 years before I gave it up.
Oh, thanks for that call, Roy. And so Sarah really illustrating that point of cigarettes being presented and given to service people.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And service people tend to be young men. And that's when, you know, we know that people become addicted to cigarettes. So the marriage between government, the military, and youth was clearly very important for many people to begin the habit. And, you know, military bases for even after cigarettes were no longer included in rations, continued to sell tobacco products at a discount.
Thanks for that call, Roy. Let's go back to the phones, and Michael in St. Paul is up. Hi, Michael.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call, and congratulations, Professor, on the new book.
Thank you.
You had said something earlier that just caught the hair on the back of my neck to stand up about cigarette smoking being calming. And I know it's 2019, we're all very aware about the health effects, but that calming that you mentioned, that has to do with addiction.
Mm-hmm.
So looking at, in terms of addiction, the reason that there's a quote-unquote a relaxing sensation is because your nicotine receptors in the brain are being satisfied by that craving.
Thank you for that clarification. I was speaking as a non-smoker, so I appreciate you clarifying that. And, you know, the addiction element is definitely a big part of the story, isn't it, Sarah?
Yeah, I'm so glad for that call and that intervention. I think that for non-smokers, it sounds paradoxical, but for smokers, you know, the necessity of calming is because of addiction itself. It's because of the craving and the need to be satisfied.
And let's talk a little bit about how the tide kind of turned against the ubiquitous nature of tobacco, the government and popular support for the products. You talk about non-smokers advocating and agitating for freedom from secondhand smoke. You refer to it as a conflict between the organized few and the disorganized many. What did you mean by that?
I mean, if you look at the trajectory of tobacco over the 20th century, what it looks like if you kind of take 100 years looking at it together is the government, the federal government, supported organized producers, whether the industry or tobacco growers, for a very long time, and it took a supreme amount of effort from individual citizens who essentially formed a social movement and used the language of rights to say, you know, where can we see vindication for for the way we want to live. And so you really see a tide turning, not with the Surgeon General's report in 1964, not when the federal government says this is cigarette smoking causes cancer, but you really start to see it when social movements mobilize in the 1970s to say, you know, whatever the smoker wants to do is fine in his business. That's not even what we're arguing anymore. We're arguing whether or not you can smoke in front of me. And so these social movements that basically invent the idea of a non-smoker, that there is a class of people that could be called non-smokers and that they should have rights, they form groups. These groups have kind of funny acronym names. The primary non-smokers rights group is called GASP, Group Against Smoke and Pollution. And they basically began lobbying city councils and eventually winning local ordinances that say that begin to restrict where people can smoke in public places.
As a result of many lawsuits and eventual legal victories against big tobacco, people on the whole found out a lot more about the lobbying and marketing efforts of big tobacco that were often targeted at minority communities and more vulnerable populations. And it was really interesting that even at a point when research was clearly pointing to the public health concerns of smoking, there was such a strong lobby and governmental support for that tobacco industry. Here's a clip from the 2005 film Thank You for Smoking, where a lobbyist for big tobacco is having dinner with alcohol and gun lobbyists.
Look, I mean, nothing personal, but tobacco generates a little more heat than alcohol.
Oh, this is news.
Well, my product puts away 475,000 a year.
Oh, okay, now 475 is a legit number.
Okay, 435,000, that's 1,200 a day. How many alcohol-related deaths a year?
Well,
100,000 tops? That's what, 270 a day? Wowee. 270 people, the tragedy. Excuse me if I don't exactly see terrorists getting excited about kidnapping anyone from the alcohol industry.
So three lobbyists trying to outdo each other in the death lobby. Yeah, the death. Yeah, exactly. So this was a very big factor that at the time, a lot of people weren't aware was going on behind the scenes.
Yeah, I think one of the most striking things about tobacco and the reason why writers and journalists and commentators can refer to the tobacco playbook was the remarkable fact of the litigation in the 90s and early 2000s has led to this trove of documents that were produced as part of the legal process of discovery. That huge trove of documents is now publicly available on an online archive. So everybody in the world has access to the inner workings of this industry in a way that we simply don't have for really any other industry. So, you know, tobacco is frequently held up as the playbook that every other industry is, you know, modeling themselves after when they try to lobby. But that might just be an artifact of the fact that we only really know a ton about tobacco because of all of these documents.
We're talking with Sarah Mylov about her new book, The Cigarette, A Political History. And let's go back to the phones, and Owen in Wauwega is up. Hi, Owen.
Yes. Hi, Jude. How are you?
Good.
I appreciate you guys taking my call. So when I was about 10 years old, I really got interested in collecting the old illustrated advertisements that were found in magazines in grandma's attic. And then, you know, I continued to find and look for those old illustrated advertisements. I really enjoy the colors and really beautiful. And started in the 1920s and up until the 50s is my favorite period. And I still have a lot of those old prints stored away. But I actually got the pleasure of working in the tobacco fields in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. And that is hard work. And it's one of the only farming practices that's still completely unmechanized. It's all done by hand, much like they did it when they started harvesting tobacco, 100 and something years ago.
Thanks for that call, Owen. We're running just a little short on time. And the advertising is a really interesting aspect, Sarah. There was once the shift went from this is an immigrant degenerate kind of habit to this is sophisticated and classy. That was a big attraction, wasn't it?
Well, and that was all due to advertising. So really, the advertising industry in the United States and the tobacco industry in the United States are absolutely intertwined. All of the big ad firms are getting tobacco dollars to fuel their growth and their expansion during the 1920s. And that, in part, is resting on the fact that during that decade, there were major tax cuts. So the tobacco industry is able to put more money into advertising.
And Sarah, briefly, as we start to wrap up, what kind of clout does the tobacco industry have today? Is it waning or is it still holding relatively stable?
That's a really, really interesting question. In a way, tobacco's influence lingers secondhand, if you pardon the pun, even though its lobbying outlays are nowhere near what they were even 10 years ago. And its influence lingers because people are still addicted to tobacco. It is still the leading preventable cause of death in the United States, responsible for nearly 500,000 excess deaths each year. And, you know, to add to that, on top of it now, in terms of the e-cigarette issue, which is now emerging as a new major important public health issue, the largest e-cigarette firm is Juul, which is Big Tobacco. Philip Morris, Altria now, owns a 35% stake in it. So tobacco and the addictive industries are not going away.
Well, Sarah, thanks so much for joining us today. It was a really interesting conversation.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Sarah Mylove is an assistant professor of history at the University of Virginia. She's the author of the new book, The Cigarette, A Political History.